Welcome to the Federal Society's Candidates Forum for the 2008 Supreme Court Judicial Election. We appreciate the co-sponsorship of our forum by the John Locke Foundation. The candidates for this seat are the incumbent, Associate Justice Robert Edmonds, and Wake Forest University Professor of Law Suzanne Reynolds. The moderator for the forum is former Associate Justice and former Dean of the Adrian Wiggins School of Law, Willis Wichard. Since 1868, Supreme Court justices have been chosen by statewide election, while there have been occasional proposed constitutional amendments for appellate judges to be nominated and confirmed as in the federal system, they have never passed the General Assembly. And polls of North Carolina voters have generally reflected a desire to retain electoral control over the judiciary. The Federal Society's forum is for the purpose of helping to make our fellow citizens make an informed decision in the election, in order that all North Carolinians have the opportunity to choose candidates. We welcome AM680 WPTF, which will rebroadcast the forum later this week. The Federal Society is also videotaping it to be available on the Internet. We encourage everybody listening or viewing to send a link to the video to anyone who would like to know more about the candidates. The link to the video is available on the Federal Society's website at www.fed-soc.org/North Carolina. You can also find the Federal Society's special report on recent Supreme Court jurisprudence at this address, which is again www.fedsoc.org, that's fed-soc.org/North Carolina. And briefly, we would like to recognize the current and former members of our judiciary here tonight. We have Justice Brady and former Justice Orr of the Supreme Court, and Judges Stroud, Calabria, and Tyson of the Court of Appeals, and Superior Court Judge Ridgway. If I have missed anybody else, my apologies, and we thank you, and as well as our candidates and moderator for your service to North Carolina. To introduce our candidates, Suzanne Reynolds is a professor at Wake Forest University School of Law. She's taught and written about family law and other subjects for 26 years. Before teaching, she practiced civil litigation with the law firm of Smith Moore in Greensboro. Professor Reynolds was born in Lexington, received her BA from Meredith College, a master's degree in English and journalism from UNC Chapel Hill, and her law degree from Wake Forest Law School. While on the faculty at Wake Forest, she was a principal drafter of the statutes that modernized the law of both alimony and adoption, and she co-founded a domestic violence program that received national recognition by the ABA for providing legal assistance to the poor. She also has written a 3-volume treatise on North Carolina family law. Justice Edmonds graduated from Vassar College in 1971 with honors, and from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill School of Law in 1975. After serving in the United States Navy as a line officer, he began his legal career as an assistant district attorney in Guilford County. And he tried over 100 cases the assistant district attorney in Guilford County. He was hired as an assistant U.S. attorney for the Middle District of North Carolina in 1982. And in 1986, he was appointed the United States attorney for the Middle District of North Carolina. In 1993, Justice Edmonds joined the Greensboro firm of Stern and Klepfer as a partner where he practiced in criminal law. In 1998, Justice Edmonds was elected to the North Carolina Court of Appeals, and in 2000, he was elected to the Supreme Court of North Carolina. Justice Edmonds has lived in Greensboro since 1957. As part of our forum tonight, we're going to have cards that we're going to pass out. Hopefully we can pass them out right now. And if you would like to ask a question, please write it on there, and we will collect them midway through the event, and we will select a few cards towards the end of the event to ask of our candidates. To introduce our moderator, Justice Wichard's distinguished biography is too extensive to recite, but it is worth mentioning that he has the distinction of being the only person in North Carolina history to have served in the North Carolina House, Senate, and on the Supreme Court. He is currently in private practice at the law firm of Moore and Van Allen. And now let me turn over the forum to our moderator, former Associate Justice Willis Wichard.
Thank you, Robert, and good evening, everyone. And let me add my welcome and my thanks to the Society for sponsoring this forum. I have been given a fairly long list of questions by the Society, which it's my understanding the candidates have seen. I will begin with those questions. I was then instructed to formulate a couple of questions from a white paper on the Society's website, which I have done, and the candidates have not seen those questions. I then have a couple of more general questions, and as Robert indicated, we will turn to the audience. At a point in the program, I will let you know to pass your cards to the aisle so that they can be collected. Robert, no one has informed me who goes first. You can flip a coin to see who got the first question.
We should go ahead and let Justice Edmonds make the call, because we've flipped coins on several occasions now. I always lose.
Call the clock. Yes, it is. So you get to choose. Do you want to go first or have
perfect record?
Have her go first.
I don't. There's so many questions. I don't really think it matters. I'll go ahead and go first.
All right. The first question is to Justice Edmonds first, and then to Professor Reynolds. Do you believe a judge's political or ideological views or their backgrounds and experiences affect how they decide cases, and if so, how?
I think experience does matter a whole lot. For instance, in my background is criminal law, and when I'm on the court working on a criminal case, it helps me to know what was going on in the trial court, what the judges and the lawyers were working on. So it helps inform my decisions as a Supreme Court, but it doesn't drive the results. It just helps make me more of an effective justice because of the background I have had as a practitioner. But if the other part of the question goes to our political views and our ideological views, and they do not affect our results, all the judges and justices I know work very hard to make sure that our political beliefs do not impinge themselves on our opinions. A classic example of that came up a couple of years ago. Many of you may remember in the 2006 election, right at the very end, that outside group fairjudges.net showed up. Put a lot of money into the judicial races. In one of those races, the numbers were Supreme Court Justice and sitting now Robin Hudson won the election, and she was challenged by Anne-Marie Calabria, who had been her opponent. Justice Hudson is a Democrat, Judge Calabria is a Republican. Because of the recusals that resulted, because several members of the court had been endorsed by FairJudges.net, the challenge that was brought by Republican Judge Calabria was considered by four Republicans on the court, me, Justice Brady, Justice Wainwright, and Justice Newby. And I can't tell you, you know, what went on in that decision, but the Democrat, Robin Hudson, sits on the court. So I think that's a very good example of how we put our politics aside and decide these cases on the law.
I think the most important background, the most important thing that you want to know about a judicial candidate is the candidate's judicial philosophy. I think you want to know whether the candidate has an appreciation for the separation of powers, you know, the brilliance of our Constitution in separating powers and having three different branches of government. That's the most important quality of a judicial candidate. Does experience, does your political philosophy have a bearing? You know, when judges define words in a constitution, and when judges define words in a statute, and when judges decide what it is that this common law doctrine means, sure, they bring their experiences to bear. You know, I probably define words differently because of the experiences I've had, because I'm an English major, because I'm a teacher, because I'm a law professor. All of that experience comes to bear on how I interpret words, how I define words. But the most important thing you should know about me is that I appreciate the brilliance of our Constitution in devising three separate branches of government that have three different responsibilities. It is the legislative branch that has the responsibility for creating the law. It is the judicial branch's responsibility for applying the law.
Second question, which will go first to Professor Reynolds. Do the federal due process clause and North Carolina's law of the land clause differ in scope at all? If so, what legal principles are relevant to how they differ?
Well, of course they differ in scope because it's different words, isn't it? The due process clause is written in different words from the law of the land clause. The due process clause of the 14th Amendment has different language from the law of the land clause. So, of course they're different. They were written at different times. The due process clause is a part of an 18th century document. The law of the land clause, part of a 19th century document that was then readopted in the 1970s. The North Carolina Constitution was reenacted in 1970. So, of course, the scope is different. And the scope is different, too, because the North Carolina Supreme Court has already told us that the scope is different. There have already been cases decided by the North Carolina Supreme Court that explain that the law of the land clause may afford more protections than the due process clause of the federal constitution. Of course, we have also acknowledged, the North Carolina Supreme Court has also acknowledged that we may look to interpretations of the federal constitution for guidance on the North Carolina constitution when those words are similar. But the scope is necessarily different because they're different documents.
The North Carolina Supreme Court has said that they are coextensive. A case written back in 1915, State versus Collins, and reaffirmed later in an opinion written by Justice Fry, Emmalile versus State, 1987 case, said that the two are coextensive. So, as a believer in stare decisis, I would not vote to change those cases.
Next question will go first to Justice Edmonds. If a previously decided North Carolina Supreme Court case differs from your understanding of the original understanding of a constitutional clause or statute, how would you approach the question of whether to vote to reverse that prior decision?
Well, of course, the Constitution controls everything we do. Now, if I come to the conclusion after doing the necessary research and reading that a case is inconsistent with the Constitution, then I would have to vote to reverse that prior case. Now, as a practical matter, that virtually never happens. I've been on the Supreme Court for 8 years. I was on the Court of Appeals before that. And in the entire time, I've never seen a case where the Supreme Court had said something was constitutional, and then the only difference being a change in personnel, it later says the same issue is, or the same cases, or the statute is unconstitutional. So we are driven by the Constitution. That's what we ultimately base our decisions on. But as a practical matter, once a case is decided, unless the Constitution changes or the statute is changed by the General Assembly, my approach to whether or not I would have voted that way if I'd been on the court when the case was originally decided is immaterial.
I would start with where Justice Edmonds ended his answer. The question asks, if a previously decided North Carolina Supreme Court case differs from your understanding, and then the question goes on, and it would be immaterial what my understanding is. I think when there would be a case that a subsequent court would not follow, when stare decisis would not apply, would depend on a number of things. One would be the passage of time. In the passage of time, have we come to understand that the public policy, for example, that animated the decision, the prior decision, have we come to understand that that public policy no longer applies, or we understand that public policy different? Have other statutes intervened to make us think that the reason underlying the previous decision no longer applies? That would be a time when we would not follow precedent. We wouldn't follow precedent also if it's that the rule that comes out of the earlier case is just incapable of a principled application. If we've discovered that the principle that was enunciated in the earlier case simply cannot be applied in a rational way, then that would be another time when we decide that we should not follow precedent. But except under those very narrow circumstances, we follow precedent. And my understanding of a different interpretation simply isn't relevant. The precedent should be followed unless for other reasons, as I say, like the passage of time, a different understanding of the public policies at issue in the earlier case, the inability to apply that principle in a principled way, those would be reasons that one would no longer follow precedent.
The next question is rather lengthy. It comes from the Federalist Society's special report on the North Carolina Supreme Court, which discusses the recent decision in State versus Oglesby. Court there considered the meaning of the phrase parent, guardian, or custodian when deciding whether a minor had a right to have his aunt present during questioning. The majority held that under the plain language of the statute, the aunt was not a, quote, parent, guardian, or custodian. Justice Timmons Goodson dissented on the basis that the aunt, in this case, should be considered the child's guardian, quote, within the spirit and meaning of the juvenile code. Justice Timmons Goodson believed that the intent of the legislature was broader than the legal definition of the words parent, guardian, or custodian. She also posited that those words should be evaluated based on the context of the situation and the police officer's perspective, not the objective language of whether the aunt was the child's legal guardian. If it appears to you that the intent of the legislature differs from the plain meaning of a statute, which do you believe should control the application of that statute? Professor Reynolds goes.
It might not be clear to you simply from hearing that question, but I've had the chance to look at the question, and I believe if you study the question assumes that the plain meaning of a statute always means the legal meaning. In other words, that the plain meaning of a statute always refers to the legal meaning of a term, so that parent, guardian, or custodian, the question equates plain meaning with legal definition. And I think the question has a faulty premise. It is not the plain meaning of the statute that we always mean the legal definition. Very often we do. But it may be that the legislative intent is not to use the legal definition of a term. The term guardian or custodian is not a term that we automatically should assume that the legislature meant legal guardian or legal custodian. So I would always look for legislative intent. In interpreting words of a statute, I teach my students that they should look at the words of the statute, and then the next place they look is for indicators of legislative intent. So I first have to come to the conclusion, is the plain meaning the legal definition? It may be, it may not be. I would have to look at other indicators of legislative intent before I concluded that the plain meaning of the statute means the legal definition of the words that are used in the statute.
This is a somewhat difficult question for me because I was on the court when Oglesby was argued, discussed, and decided. And I'm not at liberty to reveal or disclose the discussion that the court had in conference on the case. However, if I had felt that Justice Timmons Goodson's interpretation was correct, I would have joined her, but I did not. And when I was going through the LLM program, earning my master's in law degree at the University of Virginia, one of the courses we took was statutory interpretation. It's black letter law that when a statute has plain, clear meaning, you do not look any further. And I think in this case that the words parent, guardian, or custodian are pretty clear. They're not ambiguous. And when that's the case, that's the law you apply. You just use those words. Looking beyond, when the words are plain, and you look beyond them anyway, to imply what you think might be the intention of the General Assembly, is, I believe, an invitation to substitute your judgment for those of our elected officials. I do not think that's appropriate.
Next question, which will go first to Justice Edmonds. The Supreme Court occasionally cites to other state cases when deciding matters of first impression before the court. Is there also a role for the law of other countries to inform and guide the Supreme Court in interpreting the North Carolina Constitution and statutes?
Once again, that sort of feeds into the LLM course I took at UVA, where we studied treaty law one semester. Well, I understand that the United States Supreme Court does sometimes consult the laws of other countries and other nations. I would be extremely reluctant as a justice on the North Carolina Supreme Court to look outside the United States while seeking guidance in interpreting laws and statutes. Other countries have legal backgrounds, have different legal systems, different histories, and in any departure from the common law background that we have in the United States, particularly in North Carolina, I think it's just an invitation to difficulties. And it's could be a backdoor of putting your own views into the practice or making them law. As my wife once said, if you shop internationally, you can find anything you want.
Pastor Reynolds?
I can't think of a shopping analogy, but I come to the same conclusion, but maybe for a little bit different reasons. I can't imagine looking to the law of other countries and interpreting the North Carolina Constitution either, but it's because our Constitution reflects that we are a state in a federal system. And while we may draw on the experience of other states, also in a federal system, I can't imagine that we would find guidance on how to interpret the words of our state constitution in looking at the national constitution of another country. You know, the importance of our federal system is too important to think that we could get guidance on interpreting a state constitution by looking to another country's federal constitution, national constitution.
Follow-up question that's not in your script, but for each of you, Justice Edmonds, again, first, would you take a different view of English cases?
Well, we do look to English cases before the Revolution, so they are not completely out of bounds. I don't think there's anything wrong with looking at them, but I think they have virtually no value. They might have some persuasive value, but that's about it. Otherwise, the best thing you can say about them is that they're easy to read.
Mr. Reynolds?
And I would say that, well, certainly in my particular expertise in family law, we're certainly accustomed to looking to ecclesiastical courts of England and the common law of England for guidance in family law. But I answered the earlier question the way I did because it referred to the state constitution. But for common law cases, the law of England has been instructive.
Next question, first to Professor Reynolds. Tillman versus Commercial Credit Loans Incorporated, opinion issued earlier this year by the North Carolina Supreme Court, discussed in the Federalist Society's special report on the North Carolina Supreme Court, dealt with whether an arbitration clause in a loan contract was unconscionable. Justice Newby, in dissent, contends that this is the first case in North Carolina Supreme Court history to have declared a contract substantively unconscionable. Is he correct, and what is the significance, in your view, of the Tillman decision?
Did we say whether Justice Newby is here tonight? Just kidding. Justice Newby says in his dissent that it's the first case to have declared a contract substantively unconscionable. He may be correct, and I believe he is correct, that it's the first case to have declared a contract clause substantively unconscionable. But that's by that name. You know that we have adopted the Uniform Commercial Code, and the Uniform Commercial Code provides that a judge may strike an unconscionable clause. We've also adopted, you know, the official comments to the Uniform Commercial Code, and those comments begin by saying, for years, the law implicitly has declared contracts or portions of contracts unconscionable. We just haven't done it by that name. And that's certainly true. Clauses of contracts entire contracts have been found unenforceable, for example, because of fraud. When really, if you look at the quantum and quality of the evidence, the person claiming that it was unconscionable or fraudulent really couldn't carry the burden. But the judge lightened the burden of showing fraud in order to strike the offending clause or to find the contract unenforceable. So for years, by other names, the law has refused to enforce unconscionable contracts. It was just not until the adoption of the Uniform Commercial Code that we gave explicit recognition to the ability of a court to refuse to enforce an offending clause. And every state in the country has adopted Article 2 of the Uniform Commercial Code except Louisiana.
Well, as with the earlier question about the Oglesby case, I'm somewhat constrained because I participated in the arguments and the discussion and the writing of the opinion in Tillman. As a result of that, my ultimate views are on record in this case. The real significance of the Tillman opinion is that the question does point out that Justice Tillman Spitzen wrote what's considered the majority opinion. She only took two votes with her. I wrote a concurring opinion that was somewhat more limited in scope that Justice Martin joined, and because it is more limited, it is ultimately the opinion of the court. Under Tillman, the court recognized the rights of small consumers. We recognized that they often had their rights trampled, that they did not have recourse under the contract they had signed. We found that contract unconscionable, and vindicated their rights so they could come to the law. My disagreement with Justice Timmons Goodson was that in writing her opinion, she reached fairly far outside North Carolina law. She was citing law review articles. She was citing laws from other states, things of that nature. I thought it was too broad. I limited the opinion I wrote to North Carolina jurisprudence and reached the same result. So that's what I think the importance of the Tillman case is.
Next question goes first to Justice Edmonds. Professor Reynolds has noted during the campaign that the Supreme Court issues fewer opinions than it has in the past. Is this a problem, and why or why not?
Now, I would like to start out by saying that the court is not afraid to work. some years ago before I joined the court, it had a fairly substantial backlog to the extent the cases were taking until 3-4 years to get through from the time they were argued until an opinion was eventually issued. And the court made an institutional decision that this backlog was not a good thing, didn't serve the people of North Carolina well, and that the court would limit its caseload to about 100 to 120 fully briefed and argued cases per year to keep the backlog from getting too high. So we get our cases on the Supreme Court from three sources. We have to take the capital cases. They don't even go to the Court of Appeals. We have to take dissents from the Court of Appeals. And we only have control over the cases that we take through discretionary review. The last few years, the Court of Appeals has grown to 15 members. And any analysis of the numbers, the statistics about the court shows that the number of dissents has increased substantially since that court grew. And what a dissent means from the Court of Appeals is that a Court of Appeals judge is interested in the case. And after full briefing and argument and all that that implies, the court may well agree, the seven of us on the Supreme Court, that the dissent did not raise a significant issue. And if that's the case, then we will issue a one-word per curiam opinion affirming the lower court. Or if we feel the dissent nailed it, we'll issue a one-word per curiam opinion reversing the court. The upshot is that we've done all the work on the dissent that we would do for any other case, on the case that came up because of a dissent, that we would do for any other case. And it takes just as much of our time, just as much of our effort, but it does not yield a written opinion because we don't write simply for the fun of it. And I believe that the work of the court has pretty much remained constant, and the cases that we can take on discretionary review are somewhat limited because we have to take these other cases from other sources. But the court has remained busy, and the justices are hard at work.
Well, I have to take issue a little bit with the wording of the question, because the question says that Professor Reynolds has noted that the Supreme Court has issued fewer opinions. But what I've really said on the campaign trail is that there have, of the opinions, there's been a shift from signed opinions to per curiam opinions. As I have campaigned, it's been the one thing that's been constant among plaintiffs' lawyers and defense lawyers, that the Supreme Court needs more of a jurisprudence of its own, that there may be a time when per curiams are appropriate, but particularly when there are conflicting opinions coming from different panels at the Court of Appeals, a per curiam opinion is not helpful. There have been cases in which the Supreme Court has adopted a dissenting opinion as its own, when the dissenting opinion itself is names alternative bases for the dissent, or reaching the conclusion that's reached in the dissenting opinion. The author of the dissent will name alternative bases, and then the Supreme Court will adopt that dissent as its own. Under those circumstances, there's no way to know what the law of the case is. It used to be, in years past, that the Supreme Court would issue as many as 150 signed opinions per year. Its last fiscal year, it was down to 32. If we had consistent opinions emanating from the Court of Appeals, it might be appropriate. This is not the appropriate time to rely so heavily on per curiam opinions.
Next question goes first to Professor Reynolds. What is the most serious problem facing the North Carolina court system today? And I've added, and what, if anything, would you suggest doing about it?
It's easier to say what it is, Justice Richard, than to say what I would do about it. But the most serious problem facing the court system today is the unequal access to people of limited means. We wrestle with it in my professional responsibility class. We try to address it by, or note that it can be addressed by lawyers assuming more of their pro bono obligation, discharging their pro bono obligation. But the statistics are that, is it 30%? 30% of the civil justice needs of the middle class are not being addressed. Probably 10% of people, of poorer people, only 10% of their civil justice needs are being met. I think it's a crisis for our court system, access to justice by people of limited means, and I'm not sure what we do about it.
Well, I see our moderator is distracted, so I'll move right along to the same thing. I believe that probably the most serious problem faced that's internal to the court system is funding. And one of those particularly is the funding for the district court bench. The judges on that court are not, their pay is not commensurate with that the superior court judges and the appellate court judges receive. Many of the judges who are, you know, right at the right age to be good, well-trained judges also have children they've got to educate, and particularly in the metropolitan areas like Charlotte, Winston-Salem, Greensboro, and Raleigh, simply can't afford to stay on the bench. So that is proving to be that part of funding is proving to be a problem, getting translators for the courts, getting court reporters for the courts. That has proven to be a consistent problem, and we understand it. Like Professor Reynolds, I'll agree, I'm a lot better at naming problems than I am at fixing them. That's really something that I know the Chief works with the General Assembly on all the time.
If you would, at this point, ask any questions that you may have to your right. A member of the Society will collect them. As indicated earlier, they will be submitted to a committee and then forwarded to me for asking later when we're through with these. And if anyone needs paper and pencil, if you'll raise your hand, someone will get that to you. The next question, going first to Justice Edmonds. Do you believe litigation in North Carolina is too expensive? Why or why not? And I've added to the question, any cost-saving proposals?
Well,
now that we know you don't like to provide solutions.
I'm going to disappoint you again, probably, but I would have to agree with Professor Reynolds that, you know, funding is a problem. If you're rich, there's very good law provided for you. And if you're indigent, there's very good law. I think most indigent clients don't understand it, but for instance, in the criminal field, many of the best lawyers in town work for the public defender's office. So at both ends of the economic spectrum, there are options, and they're fairly decent ones, but the people in the middle are the ones who are squeezed. The ones who are just barely making ends meet can barely afford to pay a lawyer if they don't have much in the way of discretionary income. That's one of the reasons why I believe our system of contingency fee cases is effective, because it does allow people who could not otherwise pay for an attorney to have good representation. And perhaps there are other insurance programs and that sort of thing out there, but it is as proven to be a problem, and it's turned out to be a reasonably attractive one.
Justice Edmonds, that was a nice try trying to get my daughter Caroline Elliott to vote for you. He just complimented the public defender system, and I have the newest member of the Wake County Public Defenders, Hoppy's of my daughter Caroline Elliott, here on the front row, and she's still voting for me.
if she wants to come home.
If she wants to thank and have Thanksgiving dinner in a couple of weeks. Yes, it's too expensive. I mean, I've already said that. To me, that's the greatest challenge facing especially the civil justice system, is that the litigation is so expensive. When I was in practice, the lawyers sitting around the table at lunch would say, how do these people afford us? And I wonder how they do. But I do think, I'll just jump, since we all agree that it's such a problem, I'll just agree to some cost-saving measures. I believe there are some alternative courts that may help us, at least with in some areas. I believe the drug treatment courts have been effective. Again, in my area, family law, mandatory mediation has turned out to be effective. In family courts, some family courts are dealing well with pro se litigants, and maybe there are ways that we can continue to experiment to deal with pro se litigation. So I think it is experimenting with alternative courts. Here's where our federal system gives us such an advantage. We can take the benefits of states experimenting in with their own court systems. You know, law professors looking for things to write about are doing a lot of empirical research, and they are studying the experiences of other states as they experiment with problem-solving courts. So it may be that those specialized courts may provide us with some help in addressing the expense in litigation.
The next question is, who is your favorite justice in North Carolina history? And I think we should exclude the moderator, who might be an obvious choice, but we don't want these candidates currying favor with the moderator, so... Someone right. Other than the obvious choice of course well, be Wichert.
Give me just a minute to strike out Wichert.
The professor and, Reynolds
all right.
First.
Well, I'm going to say two, and one, this is currying favor with the moderator, because I believe you have written about Walter Clark, haven't you,
yep.
Justice Wichert? But when I remember reading as a first-year law student, reading opinions written by Walter Clark, and he was so eloquent, especially in his treatment of sex discrimination. He has always stood out in my mind as a favorite justice of the North Carolina Supreme Court. But then I'll have to also name Susie Sharp. Susie Sharp, first elected Chief Justice of the in the country, has always been a role model for me. She was friends with my mother's family. And she wrote opinions that I think get it exactly right. I think the best appellate opinions teach the law, and that's what Susie Sharp did in her opinions. She gave the context for the issue that was before the court, and then after she explained the context for the legal issue that was before the court, she addressed the issue in a way that left no question, and then, excuse me, and then she put her pen down. And I think that's exactly what a good opinion does. It teaches the law that's relevant to the legal issue. It decides the legal issue under the facts and the law, and then the justice puts her pen down.
You know, it's funny, we all sort of agreed that Bill Wichert was our first choice. Tough. I'm glad I had a backup. There are lots of very good justices, and one of the treats about being on the court is being able to walk the halls and look at the portraits that are there and learn about the men and women who have served on the court. But since I'm on the court and know some of them personally, I'll have to admit that that does color my view somewhat. I tend to look at my own experience, and frankly, my favorite justice is our current chief, Sarah Parker. It's been a pleasure to work with her, both when we were associates and now that she is the chief. I get to work with her. We get to agree. We get to disagree. We get to sharpen our opinions against each other. I've seen the quality of her work. I've seen the quality of her leadership as the chief justice. Most of the reasons I admire her really are based on things I see in the conference room when the door is closed and are not things I can share with y'all. But I have seen how effective she is. My office in the Supreme Court building overlooks the Capitol. And when the General Assembly is in session, a lot of times I'll look out the window between 8:30 and 9 and see that poor woman trudging over to the General Assembly to make sure that the courts are recognized and that their needs are acknowledged by the General Assembly, and that we get adequate funding for what we do. She's very effective at it. She's been a good friend. She's been a good colleague. And she's a superb Chief Justice.
All right. We get to broaden the field. And Bob, for you first, favorite jurist generally. And I think you would want to go outside the state for this, since you'd like to make one.
Well, I was going to ask, you know, there's Bill Wichard again. No, I had to, you know, I sort of thought about this, and the answer I came up with sort of surprised me a little bit, but it's Thurgood Marshall. Back right after I finished law school, I read books, I don't probably run into it, called Simple Justice. It's about the whole history of the Brown versus Board of Education, going all the way back to Plessy versus Ferguson, maybe further back than that. And a whole lot of the book is devoted to Justice Justice Marshall's involvement in the formulation of the strategy to overthrow segregation, and then his work in those cases themselves, and how often he was in physical danger, how effective the strategy was, how often it's been followed since. There are many ways in which I disagree with him, both in how I vote for president or other things. But in terms of being a great jurist and a great mind and just a guy who had a real life off the bench, I read that book. I think about Justice Marshall, and I think, what a guy.
Well, I like both of Justice Edmund's choices. And I came to mind a little differently. I'd have to say that my favorite jurist outside North Carolina is Ellen Peters. She was a justice of the Connecticut Supreme Court. And I first noticed Justice Peters because in my contracts casebooks, no matter which contracts casebook I used to teach contracts, there it would always be an inordinate number of her opinions. And again, I love her opinions like I do Susie Sharp's because they teach the law. Justice Peters was a Yale law professor, specializing in the commercial code, but also taught contracts. She went directly from being a law professor directly to the state Supreme Court, and she's widely recognized as one of the nation's best state Supreme Court justices. Eventually, she became the Chief Justice of the Connecticut Supreme Court. Her opinions are in textbooks in disproportionate numbers because they are so good. They do just what I said Susie Sharp does. She lays out the context for the legal issue. She addresses the legal issue. She lends clarity so that lawyers reading that opinion will then know how to advise their clients. She makes the law clear. That law serves us best, that is clearest. And she did that.
Thank you.
Next question. This is a multi-part question. Do you believe judges should be elected or nominated and confirmed as in the federal system? Should we return to including political affiliation on the ballot? Or should we get rid of the public financing, make candidates have to raise the money based on the strength of their experience and views? To Professor Rambis first.
I'm still not sure how I feel about elected versus a merit selection system. You know that North Carolina is studying a merit selection system along the lines of the Missouri plan, that we would have a bipartisan merit selection panel that would choose among applicants, choose three, offer those to the governor, and then the governor would make the appointment, then that person would face a retention election. Whether that's better than electing our judges, I'm not sure. Both systems have their problems. Certainly, nomination and confirmation in the federal system hasn't ensured that politics were out of the selection process. But I do know how I feel about the last two parts of that question. I do know that the races should be nonpartisan. I know that raises other issues, but, you know, 21 states still elect their appellate judges, and of those 21 states, 16 are nonpartisan. There are reasons why the trend is definitely moving away from partisan elections. It's an important symbol. is an important symbol that people don't believe that, well, at least we don't tell them that we are electing Democratic judges or Republican judges, that we don't refer to our court as a Democratic court or a Republican court. That's very important. It's a line I would not cross. And I also believe very firmly that there should be public financing. If we're going to elect our judges, surely we can agree that we ought to keep the money out of it. It's a problem in trying to educate folks about the candidates. I certainly realize that. But John Grisham's novel, The Appeal, where art is imitating life as we speak, John Grisham's novel about the problem of money electing a Supreme Court justice, and allegedly that's what's happened in West Virginia. North Carolina is very wise to have adopted public financing. One other state has done it, New Mexico, also public financing of its appellate races, and I believe many other states will see the wisdom of what we've done and also adopt public financing for their appellate races for those states that continue to elect their judges.
Mr. Edmonds.
Thank you. Well, this is my fourth judicial election, especially if you count a primary in 2000. And so I've got some experience in judicial elections. The more I work in this area, the more I have come to believe in elections. As a federal prosecutor and United States attorney by appointment, I've been involved in the appointment process, and I know how that works. And also, thanks to that federal background, I have friends who are lawyers in every state of the union, and we often talk about how their judges are selected, elected, or how they get to the bench. Every assistant, whether it's appointment, merit selection, appointment and retention, whatever system you come up with, it eventually becomes political. Even Missouri, which has the apotheosis of what's supposed to be the perfect merit selection system, is considering abandoning it because it has become so heavily politicized. So that being the case, I think it's, let's just take it the way it is and vote for our judges. I will tell you frankly, I would not be a judge in North Carolina if we had any system other than elections, because I don't know the right people. So I'm willing to go with elections. Democracy is messy, but I believe it works. As to the question of partisan and nonpartisan, I've run under both systems. That's something I don't particularly care about one way or the other. And I think whatever the General Assembly does choose to do is perfectly okay with me. I will tell you, just for information, the one thing the voters do seem to want to know whenever I'm out electioneering and campaigning is, what is your party affiliation? But I say that for information only. Public financing, again, has its good and bad points. The good point is that here we are a week before election, and we're still not out scrambling, out trying to raise checks, although I had this sort of unnerving experience today of having to return some, something politicians don't like to do. It's good that we can be out focusing on the election, that she and I are not thinking in the back of our minds how we're going to get more money. But the downside is it removes a barrier to entry. It hadn't happened yet, but it's perfectly feasible that an assistant district attorney 2 years out of law school, who's a member of a big church and has a lot of friends, could meet the qualifications to get public financing and run on a level playing field with the judge or justice who has 30 years of public service in them. And a very good record. So it's not a panacea.
Next question to Justice Edmonds first. How would you describe your overall judicial philosophy?
My judicial philosophy really doesn't fit into a soundbite. One of the nice things I can say is, having been a justice for 8 years and a judge for 2 years before that, with everything I've done on the record, if you care to look, you've got some pretty good idea of where I stand. There's certain tenets that I do try to live by. I try to keep the law consistent. People don't really think that they necessarily, you know, live their lives sort of formulated around the law, but they do, in the sense that they assume what was legal yesterday and what's legal today is going to be legal tomorrow. I don't believe it's the role of a justice to change the law just because I think a different system might be a little bit better, or something might work more appropriately a different way. So for that reason, I'm a strong believer in the doctrine of stare decisis. And I believe it's up to the General Assembly to debate openly if the law is going to be changed and let the people know what's coming. I believe we should write for lawyers so that lawyers and judges can understand what we're saying. And I believe that the opinions I've written for the court do that. People talk to me. I've never had anybody say they didn't understand what I was talking about. But I think everyone on the Supreme Court is advertent to what goes on in the United States Supreme Court, where the judges, I think, are writing for the ages rather than for the people who have to apply the law. And you get these splintered opinions that practitioners have a terrible time understanding exactly how to apply. So I think my colleagues and I work very hard to make sure our opinions are, in fact, practical and applicable. For that reason, I work very closely with my colleagues when opinions are circulating. You can get your name in the books by writing a fiery dissent, but it doesn't affect the law. I think you can do a lot better if there's something in the opinion that crosses my desk that I don't agree with. If I go to that judge and say, let us sit down and reason together and see if we can reach a result that we both agree with. The result might not have my name on it, but it often results in a better opinion that I think draws a majority and works. So that's the way I've practiced as a judge, and those are the tenets that sort of inform what I do.
I said earlier that I think the most important thing in knowing about a person and then translating that to a judicial philosophy is to understand what they believe about the separation of powers. I believe it is the genius of our federal and our state constitution, recognizing three separate branches of government, each with distinct functions. I believe it is the function of the judiciary to name the law or to articulate the law, not to create it. Apart from that, I would say that my judicial philosophy is that the judge keeps her personal views out of it. I've had a lot of practice keeping my personal views out of my professional life, as I love comments that have gotten on the campaign trail from former students who don't know whether I'm a Republican or a Democrat. They said, we certainly didn't know by how you conducted your classroom whether you were a Republican or a Democrat or what your philosophy was on any particular issue. You know, the duty of the good law professor is to tease out of students their own views and then to have the students debate those views in the classroom as I keep my view out of it. And I do that as a law professor, and that will translate very well to my judicial philosophy. In fact, it reflects my judicial philosophy that my personal views are really immaterial. It is the facts before the court, the legal principles at issue, and how those legal principles resolve the particular factual dispute. Apart from those principles, I would say that my judicial philosophy is, particularly when you're talking about the state Supreme Court, the court that is very likely, except in those rare instances when the matter goes on to the United States Supreme Court, and that's almost statistically insignificant, it is the duty of the state Supreme Court to clarify the law. Where there are conflicts, the state Supreme Court should resolve them. It should resolve them in opinions that clarify the law.
Next question goes first to Professor Reynolds. What philosopher, writer, theologian, or thinker has most influenced you?
Well, as I thought about this, I thought I would have to talk about a couple of writers. And my children, all three of our children are here, and they will want to know that whoever is keeping time is really going to work hard to keep time. And who is keeping time? Are you Robert? All right.
You haven't had to call anybody.
Because I'll have to take you back to when I was in grammar school. And when I was in grammar school, it was Jane Austen and Emily Dickinson who both influenced me the most, and their influences continued now some a number of years past grammar school. And if you know those women writers, you might understand why they were so influential. Jane Austen's heroines are very strong women who make the most of living in a time when the rules are difficult, but they are, her heroines are consensus builders. They work within the system. They stay level-headed. And they have good judgment. They make good decisions. Jane Austen and her heroines have had a powerful influence on me. Yes, I'm looking at the time. I know I may get over when I'm talking about Jane Austen. And Emily Dickinson. Emily Dickinson, I wrote my master's thesis about Emily Dickinson. And I love the law for the same reason I love the poetry of Emily Dickinson. When you read an Emily Dickinson poem, you know that every word is the only word that could have been used. The word carries so much meaning, and no other word would have done, would have served the purpose. I feel the same way about law. The words of a statute, you know, the words that we've used to portray the common law, the words of a constitution are so important. I think I derived my passion for the law and my passion to be accurate and precise about the words of a constitution or statute from reading the poetry of Emily Dickinson. Was that the final time, Robert? The women of Wake Forest, women faculty and staff gave me a little goodie bag of presents that I was supposed to open one each day until the day of the election, and one of the last packages that I just opened was a little condensed version of the poems of Emily Dickinson, and I got it in my pocketbook, carry it back and forth on the campaign trail.
Mr. Siddons?
When I thought about that question, I wasn't sure exactly which category this person fits in, but I came up with Teddy Roosevelt. I was in my third year in law school when I ran into the quote that most of you probably know about the one in the arena who's perhaps marred with sweat and blood, but who, even if defeated, has dared greatly. At that time, I wasn't enjoying law school very much. I had a couple of job offers, none of which did anything for me. And it suddenly dawned on me that I might be one of those poor, timid souls he was talking about. So that's why I joined the Navy. And that's why I've gotten involved in politics, and that's why I have done a lot of what I've done in my life. Because the importance of being a participant in our life, as Oliver Wendell Holmes mentioned, is vital. We don't want to die never having lived.
Next question, first to Justice Edmonds. What book or article, if any, that you have read recently strikes you as the most perceptive about the law today?
I think Professor Reynolds now probably finds a small area to agree in again, and that there's just not a whole lot of time for pleasure reading, particularly in my case when I've got a full-time job as a justice and I'm trying to run a statewide campaign. But I've been slowly making my way through a book called America's Blueprint. The author's name is Michael Myerson. It's about the drafting of the Federalist Papers. When I went through UVA, we reread Federalist Papers, particularly the ones pertinent to the judiciary. And I was once again just astonished by the foresight of the writers who saw so many of the issues that we have seen blossom over the centuries since they were written, about separation of powers, all those issues. And I got, after reading the real thing, I wanted to find out more about them. Shortly after I finished the UVA, I read a biography of Hamilton by a guy named Willard Randall. I had to look it up. It was so forgettable, and it never said anything about the Federalist Papers. And later I read the Chernoff biography of Hamilton, which was very good if you've read it, but it was mostly about Hamilton's role. This book, America's Blueprint, is all about all three of the authors of the Federalist Papers. And it describes small role that John Jay played and a much bigger role that Hamilton and Madison played, how they worked together and how they later became estranged. It tells you know, who wrote which papers as best people can tell. And equally interesting for us, it includes discussions of how the Federalist Papers are still being applied today, which papers are the most important, which cases they apply in. And I have found that absolutely fascinating, and I hope to finish it before I die at the rate we're going now. But it's that's the book I is most affecting me now.
Professor Reynolds.
Well, like Justice Edmonds, I haven't had much time to read on the campaign trail. I'm still teaching. In fact, I teach class in professional responsibility in the morning. So it is one of the articles that I had my students read for professional responsibility that came to mind when I saw this question. It's by Patrick Schiltz, who was a law professor, now federal district court judge. And it's on being a happy, ethical member of an unhappy, unethical profession. It's a very disturbing article. I always feel bad for my students when I assign it to them, but it really is helpful for students to chew over. It's helpful for all of us in the practice and concerned about the profession to take a look at again. But the bottom line of the article is that we should all, as members of this profession, we should remember never to leave those values that we learned at the feet of, and then you fill in the blank here, your mother, Aunt Mabel, some other beloved mentor in your life, that those lessons about morality and ethics, if we lose those when we're practicing law, then we're really lost. And it urges all of us, and I assign it to my students so that they will remember that they have to keep those lessons, the values that they brought to law school. They must not lose them as they incorporate another code of ethics on top of the one that they came with to law school. It's that article, that very disturbing article that reminds us all of some very valuable points, has probably made the most impact on me recently.
The last question in the list submitted by the Society is, what prior North Carolina Supreme Court case or cases decided in the last few decades stand out to you as having been most problematic? Question goes first to Professor Reynolds.
I'll bring up one in the family law area. The Walters v. Walters case, I believe decided in 1983, really caused a lot of problems, and I thought it was unfortunate. It's a case that provides that when parties in a dissolution, family law dissolution matter, enter into a separation agreement, if they then bring that agreement before the court to be incorporated in any way, then the separation agreement, which of course is a contract, the separation agreement loses all contract features and becomes just an order of the court. All the contract features merge into this order of the court. It caused problems because as parties are dissolving their marriage, we do want to give them as much contractual freedom as we can to resolve the dispute for themselves. And this really put the parties to a Hobson's choice. I could either keep the separation agreement purely as a contract, or I could incorporate it into a court order, and I'm going to lose all attributes, all contract-like attributes of this document by doing that. Other states had allowed parties to have both contract and order features in their separation agreements. But the bar stood up and worked it out. Good practicing family law lawyers have figured out ways around the decision. Now what parties do is just carve out the parts of the agreement that they want to retain, their contract features, and then submit the rest of the court to the court for incorporation. But it was a case that I thought had the judges had a better grasp on really what the issues were that the parties were facing, we might have reached a different result.
Mr. Sevens.
Thank you. There are a couple that I find problematic. First one that comes to mind is a case called State versus Hazelden. When I joined the Supreme Court, one of the problems we were dealing with were the closing arguments that district attorneys were using in capital cases. They were using very strong, intemperate language. I specifically remember one where a DA stopped himself just before using obscenity to describe the defendant. And the court wrote, and Justice Orr is here, he wrote the main one, but we wrote a number of opinions hauling in the DAs and telling them, act professionally in these most important cases. Anyway, in Hazelden, it was a capital case, and the district attorney's, I will summarize, argument was to the effect that the most innocent man of all time, Jesus Christ, was on the cross, and his Father, God, could have taken him down, but instead he let the process play out. And I thought that just crossed every boundary I could think of. The majority of the court said it was harmless error. Two members of the court said it was no error at all. I wrote a dissent saying that is prejudicial error, and I'm proud to say Justice Orr joined that dissent, but that case is still on the books, and I think it is bad law. The other one that I object that concerns me is called Nolan versus Village of Marvin, which involved an annexation case. The Village of Marvin reached out and annexed a nearby tract of land, and the people who lived in that tract weren't very happy about it. The majority of the Supreme Court wrote into the statute a requirement that any time a city annexes a piece of property, it has to give the people annexed something in exchange, that they get some benefit for being annexed. Well, my heart was with the majority. I think that ought to be the law, but it is not the law. The statute has no such requirement. So I wrote a dissent saying, just because we think it ought to be there doesn't mean we can put it in there. And so I think that is bad law, too, because our court, for whatever reason, broke bad and started writing law on its own, I believe.
I was tasked with developing two questions from the Society's white paper on the Supreme Court. The candidates have not been furnished with these questions, but their attention was called to the paper, so they know what's in it. And my first one will go first to Justice Edmonds, and the second one first to Professor Reynolds. First one is, First Amendment questions most often come before federal rather than state courts. Last year, however, the North Carolina Supreme Court decided the case of Harris versus Matthews. A 4-2 majority, Justice Martin not participating, declined to intervene in a property dispute between members of a church and the leadership of the church, including the pastor and governing council. It did so in the belief that it was, quote, constitutionally forbidden from intervening in an action where, quote, a party challenges church actions involving religious doctrine and practice. The dissenters saw the case as a property dispute between members of the church and its leadership that did not implicate First Amendment concerns. Justice Edmonds did not write in the case, but voted with the majority. Comment on the specific case, if you wish, but more importantly, share with the audience your general philosophy regarding church or religion/state cases. How porous, if at all, is the wall of separation between church and state that Jefferson referred to in his 1802 letter to the Danbury Baptist Association?
The question probably is going to be a little bit longer than my answer. But, I don't think it's appropriate for me to discuss that case particularly because I was involved in it. I will tell you, it does give me the opportunity to tell you one of the great pleasures of being on the Supreme Court is working with my six colleagues, I guess five in that case since Justice Martin was recused. And watching how people play off against each other, how these cases, how the opinions, majority opinion and the dissents and any concurrences, there weren't any in this case, are worked out. And I think Justice Newby and Justice Hudson did a very good job each of articulating their point of view and setting out the reasons for their point of view and why they voted as they did. My personal view is that the church, as indicated by my dissent in Hazleton, which implicated church-state matters because that the case, the opinion, the dissent, because I didn't win, the dissent does talk about the inappropriateness of bringing church matters into the courtroom. So I believe the wall, though it's not airtight by any means, it's not a hermetic seal. There is a place for in court for religion, but it's a very limited place, and I would be quite cautious in how ecclesiastical matters are brought into the our jurisprudence.
And I will not indicate how I would have ruled on that case because I haven't looked at the record. I mean, I would say that about any case, that I can't say how I would have ruled on it because I would have to study the record and know the have a much better understanding and knowledge about the facts before I would do that. But I would say that appreciate that it is porous to this extent. If there is an issue before the court involving the church, like a property dispute, that may be decided on secular law principles, then the court properly decides it. It is only when the property issue that's before the court necessarily involves deciding church doctrine and applying church doctrine that it violates those principles of entanglement, that it unnecessarily and improperly entangles the court in the affairs of the church. But when a property issue involving a dispute among members of the church, if that property issue can be decided on secular law principles, then it does not raise an entanglement problem and the court properly decides it.
The second question from the white paper. The Supreme Court was again divided in the workers' compensation case of Frost versus Salter Path Fire and Rescue. The majority, with Justice Edmonds joining, denied compensation to a volunteer emergency medical services captain who was injured in a go-kart collision during a fun day sponsored by the Fire and Rescue Service. The majority held basically that the injury did not, quote, arise out of and in the course of the employment as required by the workers' compensation statute. The dissenting justice would have held that the record sustained the Industrial Commission's findings of fact and that those in turn supported the Commission's conclusions of law. Among the findings was one that the chief had told the plaintiff he wanted her to attend and that improving morale in a voluntary organization amounts to a tangible benefit. Again, comment on the specific case if you wish, but more importantly, share with the audience your general philosophy regarding the interpretation and application of the Workers' Compensation Act by the courts.
Well, again, I won't comment on how I would have decided that case, but on general principles of statutory interpretation that would apply, of course, to the Workers' Compensation Act, the first place we would look is at the words of the statute. We'd look at the words of the statute. Apply it if it's plain. It rarely is plain. We would have to look for evidence of legislative intent. We'd look at the purpose of the Workers' Compensation Act. I know it's to be broadly construed to achieve the remedial purpose of the statute. But beyond giving you a class in legal research and writing and principles of statutory interpretation, I don't think I have further comment.
I don't think, because I participated in that case, and anything I wanted to say should be on the record. in that case, that any further comment about that Salt Path case would be appropriate on my part. The workers' compensation law, in my opinion, and again, my opinion of whether law is a good one or not really is immaterial, but I think it is a very effective law. It's been on the books for a long, long time, and what it does, of course, is it tells the workers, if you're injured on the job, you're going to get quick compensation, but you're not going to get large compensation. That's the trade-off. Sure, remediation, but not excessive remediation. I think from everything I have learned on the court, working and reading these cases, it tends to work pretty well. And the ones we see as judges and justices are the aberrational cases where things went off the trolleys, perhaps a little bit. But for the most part, we tend to be, or as part of our doctrine, is to be very deferential to the Industrial Commission and its findings of fact. And generally what we deal with, a lot of the petitions we get, a lot of the cases that come up to us where people are asking us to take the case on discretionary review are ones where there's just a factual disagreement about what happened. The law in those areas is pretty well decided, and there are interesting cases. There usually can be challenging cases where issues of law do arise. But in answer to your question, I think that the law of workers' compensation is reasonably well settled, and the court has a lot of expertise in this area.
The next two questions are general. The candidates have had no advance notice whatsoever. And I may need security to get out without their killing you, Robert. But the first one will go first to Justice Edmonds, and the second one first to Professor Reynolds. The state of North Carolina, in anticipation of a nuclear attack on Raleigh, has provided a subterranean bunker for members of the North Carolina Supreme Court. The bunker is equipped with the basic legal books so that the work of the court can continue until the nuclear proliferation has passed and it is safe to emerge. Because oaths may need to be administered during this period, Bibles are also provided. Because of space limitations, each justice can take only one book into the bunker. Excluding the Bible, which is already available, what book would you choose and why?
Oh, my gracious. Well,
you can take a few seconds if you want to on this one.
Well, I have to, usually the question we usually get is, what is your favorite book, which is a whole different question. My favorite book was The Killer Angels by Michael Shera about the Civil War. But if I were saying, what are you going to take, the classic Desert Island question, what are you going to take, I would probably take The Poems of Tennyson, which I've always loved.
Well, I will exclude the poetry of Emily Dickinson, since I've already raved about that. But if this is for the purpose of guiding the justices as they're in that bunker, I believe I'd take The Nature of the Judicial Process by Benjamin Cardozo. My students know I always love a Cardozo opinion. And I picked that up again recently. It speaks to us just as clearly as it did when he first wrote it. I think it continues to guide judges wisely as they apply the law.
I should say to Justice Edmonds that I had lunch in Tennyson's house a little over a month ago, and he showed up and read some of the poems.
Are you a part of all that you have met?
Yes. The next question, to Professor Reynolds first. The nuclear attack has suspended the laws of nature and made it possible upon your emergence from the bunker for you to spend an evening with any figure from human history. with the exception of Jesus and his disciples and the Apostle Paul, who have declared themselves unavailable. Whom would you select to spend an evening with and why?
The person who comes to mind is Eleanor Roosevelt. I always admired her. I admire her passion for human rights. I admire the work she did nationally and internationally. I believe she stood for some of the best of the American experience. And I think she elevated the discussion about what the best of the American experience is. And I'd love to sit down and chat with her about that.
Glad I had the second to think about it. The name that popped into my head was Abraham Lincoln, an absolutely astonishing human being. He's the man who saved our nation. He's a man who became a great war leader. I recently, a couple years ago, read a book about the title, it might have been called Lincoln's Sword, about how he developed as a writer over the course of his presidency. They say of Churchill that he put the English language in uniform and marched off the war. I know I'm misquoting that, but he motivated our country. I can still remember when I was U.S. Attorney going to the Lincoln Memorial in Washington and reading the second inaugural and just feeling the chill of those words. But that would be my choice.
First of the questions from the audience, and let me say to the candidates, this does not deal with the case or controversy, but with the rules. It's something you may have to deal with, so you may want to think about whether to answer it. It relates to assignments of error. Federal appellate courts do not require assignments of error. North Carolina is one of only a few states that require them. Several attorney groups, the Appellate Rules Committee, have all taken official positions in favor of abolishing them. Your thoughts on the question of abolishing assignments of error? You know, if you don't appeal to Justice Edmunds first.
I have three kids. That issue is before the court now. That issue, that proposal has been presented to the court. I'm on the Appellate Rules Committee and recused when that issue was raised there. I am proud that I was on the court when we issued the opinions, one by Justice Hudson, one by Justice Martin, that I think cleared up some of the problems that were being caused by Court of Appeals and interpretations of the rules and getting cases dismissed. But since that issue is a case of controversy or matter before the court, it would be inappropriate for me to go into it.
I have never thought that the rule requiring assignments of error has been helpful. It seems to me a trap for the unwary. It does not seem to me to focus the issues, to bring any clarity to the appellate process. I believe that we should try to resolve cases on the merits. It should be that rare case where there is a dismissal of an appeal for a minor infraction, and the assignments of error seems to me to be a minor infraction, particularly because it is not helpful in focusing the issues.
Next question, first to Professor Reynolds. The general statutes give an automatic appeal from the Court of Appeals for issues involving a substantial constitutional question. How do you interpret what is a substantial constitutional question?
The easiest answer is that a substantial constitutional question is one that affects a great number of people. When it's a matter of public education, for example, it would be a substantial constitutional question. If it's resolving conflicts that have plagued either the Court of Appeals or the trial courts, it'd be a substantial constitutional question. So its impact, I think we look first to its impact in deciding whether it's substantial.
It is something of a term of art, and in many cases it's one of those things you know it when you see it. Many of the cases that raise these issues before the Supreme Court also raise the identical issues on a petition for discretionary review so that we can review them either as constitutional issues or not as we see it as seems most appropriate. And since it is the doctrine of the court to avoid a constitutional decision when a case can be decided on a non-constitutional grounds, what we will usually do is allow the case to come up on the discretionary review. And if it needs to be decided on constitutional grounds, so be it. But otherwise, we try to deal with it on a less sweeping, less definitive, not definitive, but a way that does not necessarily implicate the Constitution of North Carolina.
The last question from the audience has been dealt with to some degree, but we'll close with it. And Justice Edmonds, for you first, what is the best way to select appellate judges in North Carolina?
We have dealt with that to some extent. It's not self-evident that one system is better than any other. As I said, I'm perfectly happy with elections. That gives us both a chance to discuss with the people who are electing us our various qualifications. It entitles me to point out that I have been a judge before, that I've been a partner in a law firm, that I am board certified. I think these things matter to voters. Otherwise, it becomes a question of who do you know, who are you friends with. So I think the election is as good as any and better than most.
I think it gives the state of North Carolina the opportunity, as I mentioned earlier, to think about our federal system. Let's get the best of the features of how other states are selecting their judges. We can compare. We can do research on it. I think one feature that we want to keep is that we want to continue public financing. As long as we're going to elect judges, it seems to me self-evident that we have to continue the public financing. But when we have the combination of public financing and nonpartisan races, what should the rules be? I think we ought to take advantage of the experimentation that's at work right now in other states to see what is the best combination of features if we continue to elect our judges. But one thing that should remain is the public financing.
We have concluded right on time. I want to thank Justice Edmonds and Professor Reynolds for conducting themselves with both ability and civility, and thank the Triangle Federalist Society for sponsoring this forum. Mr. President, I'll turn the floor back over to you.